Today on Deep Dive into Water Safety, we're focusing on a critical but often overlooked aspect of drowning prevention and aquatic safety, the mental health and operational impacts experienced by lifeguards and allied aquatic professionals. Lifeguards around the world respond to high-risk, high-consequence incidents, rescues, near drownings, fatalities, and repeated exposure to trauma. Yet historically, their experiences have not always been documented or studied in the same way as other first responder professions. This conversation today is part of a growing international effort to better understand those experiences and strengthen the systems that support the people doing this work. I'm excited today to be joined today by three guests who are extremely experienced and professional and will give us accurate information on what is cutting edge now, who are helping move this field forward through research, practice, and collaboration. Tyler Anderson is a recognized leader in the field of critical incident stress management and mental health support for lifeguards and first responders. His work focuses on addressing the psychological impact of high-risk, high-stress incidents, including rescues, fatal drownings, and repeated exposure to trauma inherent in aquatic si safety and emergency response. A central theme of his work is that drowning prevention does not end with a successful rescue. It advocates for comprehensive care models that address what happens after critical incidents, recognizing that untreated psychological stress can affect decision-making, job performance, and long-term retention of experienced lifeguards. Dr. Jaz Laws is an Australian researcher and surf life-saving professional recognized for her work at the intersection of aquatic safety, drowning prevention, and lifeguard well-being. Her career combines applied research with frontline operational insight, helping translate evidence into practical input improvements for lifeguard agencies worldwide. A key focus of Dr. Law's work is the psychological impact of critical incidents on lifeguards and emergency responders. She has helped bring visibility to the cumulative mental health burden associated with the repeated exposure to rescues, fatalities, and near-miss events, emphasizing the need for structured post-incident support, peer programs, and organizational responsibilities. And last of our three experts, Dr. Samantha Fine, focuses on trauma, critical incident stress, occupational and mental health in high-risk professions. Her expertise centers on understanding how repeated exposure to traumatic events impacts first responders and how organizations can provide effective evidence-based support. Dr. Fine emphasizes that mental health care for lifeguards should extend beyond immediate debriefing and short-term interventions. Her work highlights the importance of organizational responsibility, ongoing monitoring, and culturally competent support systems that recognize the unique stressors of lifeguarding and emergency response. I could go on for the next 20 minutes, and I probably went on too long, but I had to give you all some kind of credibility in front of our listeners because you're amazing people that have taken your time today to talk about a critical issue, and that is the mental health of lifeguards. So let's start maybe with Tyler, because we have the three of you. I mean, we have this study that we're talking about that I did not mention. It's a first of its kind, international study on mental health. And I would like to know, you're all part of the ILCIR, which is the International Lifeguard Critical Incident Response Alliance. So whoever wants to take that and run with it, tell us what you're doing and how important it is as an international issue, because we know drowning is an international issue, a global issue, and that it is preventable, and that somehow in this idea of rescue, we forget that last piece that Tyler talked about in the
Thank you,
beginning of my introduction.
Carter. Definitely, We really have seen that there was a kind of a distinct need in the industry for better support services for lifeguards, and we suspected that lifeguards were experiencing some of the same critical incidents that other first responder groups are exposed to. And we wanted to make sure we documented that because as we did a research, kind of a gap analysis, we realized there wasn't a lot of research out there on this topic. We just did not find the breadth of information that was out there for other first responder groups. We were able to find about four studies that were applicable after a literature review. And if we look on the flip side of other emergency services occupations, there were over 115,000 results for research supporting, their mental health in the aftermath of a critical incident. So we created the International Lifeguard Critical Incident Response Alliance to start to help the industry coordinate and centralize kind of a repository for information sharing, research, and just looking at what are the best practices, because there are varying models depending on what country you're in, and in terms of how we deal with critical incident stress, and best practice models that we can learn from around the world. And so we just wanted to bring together all of these professionals from different organizations to be able to collaborate on how we can best support lifeguards, their allied aquatic professionals such as supervisors, beach patrol captains, swim instructors, people that work around them that might also be helping to support the response process. And we have partnered with Kennesaw State University just outside of Atlanta, Georgia, in Kennesaw, that is leading this particular research study. And it's been distributed throughout the world. We shared it at the World Conference on Drowning Prevention back in November. And we've received input from many major countries around the world. It has not been translated into every language, so we are restricted, on that respect. But as of latest count, we have well over 1,000 responses worldwide so far.
So let's backtrack a little bit just for our listeners. When was this mental? It's called, what is the name? It's called the International Aquatic Personnel Critical Incident Prevalence and Impact Study. Is that correct?
Possible for sure. Yes, it opened on World Drowning Prevention Day,
Yes.
July of last year, and it will run through July of 2026. We wanted to keep it open for a year so that we could capture both the aquatic swim seasons in the northern and southern hemispheres of the world.
Well, that's really exciting. I know that you passed it on to Kalani Vieira here, the study to do for the Hawaiian lifeguards, and I hope that people in the United States are supporting your work. But you just told me the reason why you're doing, but what, in the first question I brought up to you is, what gap did you see in lifeguard support that led you to create this mental health survey?
So in my other hat, I work to help manage the critical incident stress management team for crew members at American Airlines. And I have worked with other airlines. And by doing that, I'm also involved with other emergency services personnel through an organization called the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation, which links a lot of us that work in the critical incident stress management field together. And just seeing how critical incidents are managed in other first responder communities, and in corporate applications, I saw a real gap and just that there was not, the formalized, support processes, that were available to other first responder groups. And, me looking at this from the outside, just said, well, this is kind of unacceptable. we should not be exposing, adolescents to events and not be providing them at least the same resources that other first responders have access to. And so that's why I really had a passion to start the organization. And I think all of us on the call here today will say we don't have this all figured out. We are working with our respective agencies and countries to start this process, and it's going to be a multi-year process to bring good support resources to the industry. And I know here in the US, we are working with the different lifeguard certification agencies, some of them, and we've got to look at how do we fundraise, how do we fund these types of teams. Most critical incident stress management teams are handled within organizations, but most aquatics organizations, luckily, don't have enough of these events to be able to warrant having a team in-house. And so here in the US, we've taken kind of the approach that we are going to develop a aquatic critical incident response team for the basically for the US that we can onboard people that are trained onto, and then they have recurring training that has to occur every so many years. And then when they are supporting someone at their facility and they need some additional support, we've got some additional support resources within our organization. They can pass those on to if somebody needs some additional support. And then if it is in a case where we need to provide referrals to trauma-informed mental health professionals that are used to treating critical incident stress with modern modalities like EMDR therapy or cognitive processing therapy or whatever the kind of the latest resources are for a master's level clinician or a doctoral level clinician to treat that. We will help them find a suitable clinician to be able to see them. And in Australia, they have a bit of a better handle from my view, and I'll let them kind of talk about this, is because they have I think an organization that's donated their employee assistance program and has allowed their lifeguards to access mental health counseling as a part of an employee assistance type benefit, which I think they call their Lifesaver Assistance Program there within Surf Life Saving Australia. So really they are kind of leading the way, I think, in the world as far as I can tell. I've spoken to a number of organizations around the world, and Australia is definitely on the forefront of the research and national strategy. And so that's why I'm really excited to have them on today's call so they can discuss what's going on in Australia, because we're learning a lot from them, and will be utilizing the research they're doing there to further refine our response strategy here in the US.
Well, that's really good. I think the assumption, at least here in the United States, from what I understand, is that lifeguards are not considered first responders. And if they were, we may not be having this discussion. I don't know.
Well, I might be able to provide a little bit of the
Yeah.
Australian perspective and the surf, and I'll do it from an organizational perspective. And then I might
Okay.
throw to Sam, who also she's a a clubby. So she's been a member of SLS since she was 5. So she can speak from that other side. She's also our national wellbeing advisor. So she can really speak to the operational side of what we've been working on. But similarly to Tyler, back in 2018 there was, or 2019, there was the Senate, a Senate report which looked at the people behind 000, which is your 911, so our emergency services call, and trying to understand the psychological distress felt by these members from being in their role, as part of their role. This report was like one of the groundbreaking documents to actually bringing mental health and mental ill health, particularly for the emergency services, to the notice of the government and to the community. However, we found that there was no inclusion of lifeguards or lifesavers. Lifesavers, for all of those at home, lifesavers, surf lifesavers are volunteer lifeguards who generally work on the weekend, where our paid lifeguards generally work Monday to Friday. So it's sort of a balance over those peak times so that we can ensure all our beaches are covered, as many beaches as possible are covered with life-saving services. So this massive omission, where there's a huge population of who are effectively emergency responders, and the people who are on the scene first, before paramedics, before only really bystanders will be the people who might get there before the lifesavers and lifeguards. So there was a big omission for that, realizing that that hadn't been included. So SLSA, and really driven by Sam Fein, who we led this research project, and it hasn't been smooth sailing. Been quite a journey, because I'm not sure how it is in Hawaii or how it is in America, but often discussing mental health and these conversations 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, were still not everyday conversations. So we really had to break down the stigma at that organizational level to be able to have these conversations regularly with our different committees. And that was within staff, within volunteer groups, within our life-saving committees, who are a blend of staff. And so really having these regular, being the squeaky wheel, if you will, just trying to make sure that our message came through. And now it's really, fortunately, it's sort of become an everyday sort of conversation within, at least within the majority of the surf life saving community. And we did run, we wrote a survey, which we ran first, like in, and it was during COVID, so it was a little bit difficult in some ways. However, it was really the first survey of its kind to actually understand volunteer members. And we also included an adolescent survey, because a lot of our members are actually between 13. They can actually patrol a beach from 13, so 13 to 17. So we felt that it was absolutely necessary to capture and understand their experiences on the beach. Through these, we run this survey again, and we plan to do it sort of every other year. And it's also been supporting the survey that's been distributed by Tyler, which is it's been we really welcomed the opportunity to support the stuff being done by ILCRA and be a part of that project and journey as well. But the results of that have come to a few research papers, which we've pulled together, and also lots of workshops with members and different emergency service conferences, and really trying to broaden the scope. Now, a lot of the EAP services provided by external services now include life-saving services as well, some of them, which is really promising to see. And we've also just released our national wellbeing framework, which really sets out a task, and keep us accountable about how can we continue driving the health and physical and mental health of our members across the movement. I will pass now to Sam, who can give an overview of how that is for like at the club level, and what that works as a through the different levels of organisation. But nationally, we're really proud of where we've gotten to, and it's just such an exciting thing to see it go
That's pretty
nationally, go
impressive, I'd say.
internationally.
Very much so, Jazz.
Thanks, Jazz. So I guess as Jazz has mentioned, I basically born and bred into life saving. Started as a nipper at 5, which is basically like a junior activities program. You learn basic CPR skills from a very early age, learn how to read the surf, learn how to swim in the surf, and essentially for a good 10 solid years. Is in a junior nipper program where you're becoming a lifesaver. And then got my surf rescue certificate at 13 years of age. And then my bronze medallion at 15. Was a very shy lifesaver, very timid. And I feel like from lifesaving, there's a lot of development programs. There's so many different avenues to go down and explore. different skill sets and whatnot. And from there, it kind of progressed through to a patrol captain at a young age, and then all the way up now until basically the National Wellbeing Advisor role and the Queensland State Life Saving Officer. And I think there's a lot of things along the way that have kind of steered into this conversation. And a lot of it has had to do with conversations on the beach, in committee meetings, just being around people and listening and hearing and seeing things. And I have some really close friends that have been very vulnerable and very strong, and open and raw about their conversation with mental health, probably in 2017 at some of our national leadership colleges. And they're like the cream of the crop that comes from all different states and territories together. And it was the first time that I'd actually encountered someone being so raw and open about their mental health journey and the conditions and illnesses that they've encountered. And I thought, wow, if someone who's in this cream of the crop and a leader in their state are having these things occurring, and it's the first time I've heard anyone actually open about it. We've had a very taboo stigma of, she'll be right, no blood, no sweat, no tears. And so I think we've always been driven as like the heroic, stoic lifesaver that you need to be strong physically and mentally to save someone else. So don't show any vulnerability, and always be as strong as you can. But I feel like the vulnerability is being as strong as you can as well. So there is that double-edged sword to it. And I don't know, it was just hearing a lot of conversations, and it kind of got to a point where I'd heard from a lot of different states and territories from friends and colleagues and peers and all of that, that I thought, there's so much going on here, but I can't see or I can't find anything that's helping in the same avenue or exploring this or where are we going about it. And as an early career researcher, I thought, well, this is a great opportunity to kind of be that gatekeeper. I have so much rich knowledge, from an operational sense as a lifesaver, and I've seen it and breathed it for so long now. And then coming in, I guess, with the research skills as well to go, there's a way to complement this and really drive it forward. And as Jazz has said, we didn't know anything at that point in time. So it was great to, I guess, essentially open the Pandora's box and go, how do we go about this from an evidence-based practice and remove any conflicts of interest and bias and go, where do we start and how do we start it from that point of view? And then kind of build that practice into play. Took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get where we are today. But as Jazz has already said, there's been so many more conversations and the impact that has been had from this level of now having everyday conversations that has kind of really mirrored along society after COVID, where mental health really came out as this is something we can talk about. The loneliness epidemic that came through with COVID, I think, really helped to push that forward from a society level. And then from Surf Life Saving as the community that reflects and mirrors our community as well, it really helped to push that into play as like, let's have an everyday conversation and let's build this more than what it was previously. So yeah, there's a lot that's happened from an operational and the research evidence-based practice, I guess, at this point in time too.
So it sounds like you've been doing this work for maybe, I don't know, almost 10 years, since
Since
2017,
2020.
all of you.
We brought it in, well, we brought it in some national life-saving meetings in 2019, and then 2020 was when COVID hit and we'd had it all ready to go with our survey. So timing wasn't our best play there, but I think it really did help to start that conversation because that was a time where we didn't know how long it was going to go for and what was going to happen. And essentially, where Jazz has said, we've got it running nearly every 2 years now, is we're able to track that. And it's not just mental health and the conditions that come with it as well, isn't a standpoint in time. There is that momentum that comes with it. So tracking it over a number of years and continuously really helps to kind of shape that conversation and see where we're at and where we're heading as well.
So
Yeah.
you're involved in this national well-being plan, or what do you call this? Is it
Framework.
framework? Okay. And
Yeah.
so you're doing this research every 2 years, and you're getting feedback. Can you discuss any of those findings? Is that
Yeah,
something you can
look.
create, be part of this survey, or?
Yeah, definitely. So I think all of our findings have really helped. We provided feedback and helped shape the survey being run by Tyler and the Ilkra team. For me, one of the most important findings, and I don't know how relevant this is in the US, but I think it might be relevant for particularly for Hawaii. It's the community aspect, and how, so with our system in New South Wales, we have our club systems, and they really are generally like, it's sort of like a second family, or it's intended to be like a second family, or a community. You have this strong sense of community and belonging. And we found, we did a study on trying to understand the protective factors of being part of the club and how that impacted on the negative aspects of mental health, and like how that increased, what that relationship was with post-traumatic stress symptoms. And the study, which came out last year actually, really showed that the club environment in general was quite protective and helped build that sort of sense of community and sense that it's like, that they have the capacity and the self-efficacy and the coping capabilities within themselves to deal with that level of stress. So that was really positive from us from an organizational perspective, in saying that one of the big findings that we found in a paper that Sam led 2 years ago was that still stigma and shame, of what other people may think of them if they showed that vulnerability. We found that that was still like, it was going to increase these stress symptoms. So that's something that we're really looking forward to monitor, both within Australia, but also to see how that sort of fits with some of the results that we see with Tyler's team, to really see how that changes, because there has been a massive shift in the community, at least in Australia, but I think it's been global as well, with talking about mental health and seeing how that impacts, being more, it's okay to be not okay,
Right.
and that's been really, really important. So that's something that's really exciting for us to be able to track in the next survey that we do, and really just and then to see how we can benchmark that, or work with Tyler to get that international perspective as well.
The international perspective is really the key, I think. I think in the United States, and Tyler can speak better to this than myself, but lifeguards aren't first responders, and most people don't know that. And at least in Hawaii, there's the discussion, and even the United States, what are we going to do about this? So in Hawaii, from what I know right now, they're trying to get some legislation passed or on the dockets to talk about them being first responders and why. And when I did an interview with Kalani Vieira, who is head of all the lifeguards here in Kauai, he was pretty open, and has been, about the mental health strain of the job that nobody talks about. And so that was, and he said, as lifeguards, as you said, or maybe it was Sam who said that, you're the initial responder, right? Before just somebody on the beach. You're not the fire person or the EMT. You're the person that actually gets there first. And Kalani Vieira was saying, we need a new name for us. We're first responders, but maybe we're initial responders, but he's looking for a new name. So all that's been a discussion, like you're just saying. And I think it's good that we're talking about it here, because your work is really important. And when we hear in the United States people doing something like they're doing in Australia or Great Britain, because I've talked to people in the UK at the Surf Life Saving Association, and so they've been interviewed on the show, and they talk about just the things you've just mentioned and how important the club is, and it's a family and all of that. But I don't want to regress in that. But the
We're just
EAP is an interesting idea. I don't know how that would work here in the United States. We have EAPs, but.
Well, it's complex in Australia too. I might let Sam talk about that, because we have a federated model, which makes things a little, less clear.
But I think just talking helps to get people talking about these are issues that need to be addressed. Drasko Bogdanovic, in his podcast and in his work, wrote a poem called Red Isn't Armor, and is exactly what you're talking about, right? That wearing the red shorts isn't making me less vulnerable to emotional distress. And so That's exactly what you're talking about. It's becoming an issue that people in the United States are talking more and more about.
Yeah, I think there's also this factor too for lifeguards that they're responsible for preventing the injury, which are preventing the drowning in many cases, and other first responder groups don't have that burden on them. So the lifeguards and the teams that we've supported, that clearly comes out as sort of a what kind of what we call a moral injury. Where they feel like they have inherently done something incorrectly, or and so there's many factors to this, and we just have to do better as an industry in taking care of those that are in our duty, our duty of care. This is something that we must do better at. I realize it's something that we it's there's no easy solution to this and no easy way to fix this. But we are having those conversations and starting to move the needle little by little, but it is going to take time. It's going to take effort. It's going to take people that are committed, volunteers, and it's going to take money as well. And that's one of the things that I see even already is it takes a real internal champion that is guiding the process. For someone in an organization to sort of build their own team. And, they have those individuals like Sam that are champions for programs and peer support programs. They're in Australia, other organizations. I'll point out one, the Royal National Lifeboat Institution has a lifeguard operations branch. They have a peer support program in New Zealand. They have peer support programs. So it is something we are seeing as a global initiative that this is, we're trying to basically catch up with what other first responder groups have had access to now for 20 to 30 years, depending on what part of the world you're from. So it is going to be a process, and it's going to take a concerted effort to the industry. It's not something we can rush through. And have an hour conversation, and you're going to have a plan put together. This takes time, effort, and dedicated resources.
Do you see any of you running any kind of workshops, places
So we,
to start these kind of support groups? Like if I said, wow, in Kauai, we'd like to have that. For an example, anecdotally, we had a drowning 2 weeks ago. It's kind of common here. And a lot of people witnessed it. And I think, and a lot of them were school children on an outing.
Yeah, and that's another factor that is somewhat outside of our program. We're delivering critical incident stress management, which is typically for people that have an occupational duty to respond to an emergency, where it's typically utilized. But there are absolutely, I would love to see better support structures for, those that are witnessing these events, and being exposed to this, secondary trauma that they're experiencing through either seeing it on TV or seeing it in person. There definitely is a gap there, for sure.
But you
Just
could come and do training to lifeguards on this kind of.
But this in the US right now, we've got two training programs. One is called Resilience First Aid, which is basically peer support training for everything up to a critical incident. And then we have another program called Critical Incident Stress Management for the Aquatic First Responder. That class teaches the post-incident support process. So my kind of from seeing this and me managing this from the airline where I see lots of these events, I see the people that do this the best are people that do this more often, like anything else. If you do it frequently, you get good at it. And so we're kind of taking the approaches. We'd rather train a handful of people that are good at the critical incident stress management, the post-incident response that can respond virtually, to any location, and then the day-to-day peer support, mental health, occupational stress, working with the employer, will be handled by the resilience first aid peer supporters. So they're going to work hand in hand with the aquatic critical incident response team, which is the post-incident response. But that's as we're starting this out, we're trying to maintain the quality of these interventions and ensuring that they're being done with the highest degree of fidelity to the model that we're using here in the US. Other countries use different models, but so that's the way we've initially set this up. And yes, so if organizations are interested in having conversations about how can they can participate and build their own teams, I would welcome them to reach out to us at info@ilcira.org. You can also go to our website at ilcira.org. And our resilience first aid classes were just posted. We have a class in March, April, and May that is being run virtually, and it's open to anyone that wants to participate in that. Again, that's not the post-incident response process, but that does deliver basically the proactive peer support training for you to start to build a peer support team within your organization. And Association of Aquatic Professionals members get a pretty healthy discount, so I would recommend you joining them before you enroll the course. There's a course code you can get in their member resource center for a discount. But
We'll put that at the end of this interview, but that's really a good resource for people here in Hawaii to know about in Kauai. That would be great.
but it doesn't have to be just in the US. Anybody can take those classes. That's actually a program that we I took a number of programs. We've customized it to aquatics. But that's actually a program out of Australia. That's where I found the best product. That was sort of an off-the-shelf product that we could use to then work as a baseline to customize. Jazz and Sam have used I think they're building their own in-house program, which they can do because they have some resources and that we don't necessarily have access to here in the US. With they have kind of embedded research managers and things that here in the US we're not quite to that point yet. But I'll let them talk about what they're doing to train their staff there in Australia.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that.
Absolutely. So I think people are our greatest strength, and in that essence, we have had for I'd be nearly 20 years now embedded into the program, into life saving, the peer support program. So what happened was it basically got reinvented the wheel from our other frontline emergency services, from our police, and they had a peer support program in there as well. And in essence, it's come from other frontline responders. They've done this, and we've mirrored and had really good results from it in terms of there's still, I guess, that stigma that comes through from any frontline responder still to this day of if you do feel like something is not okay, or you want to have a chat. Sometimes you don't want to go straight through to the first end of going to a clinical psychologist. And so, where it's been built in is if you have a critical incident, whether it's on the beach or off the beach, that occurs and you're a lifesaver or a lifeguard. And now, this varies from the complexities of our federated model of each state and territory have embedded this in a different way because we are governed in different ways for states and territories. But in the essence, is if you're for example, on patrol and a traumatic incident occurs, and you've had either an unsuccessful or a successful resuscitation, you'll get contacted by a peer support officer who is a volunteer that has been trained within the organization, usually with some sort of mental health first aid training that's been appropriate. You've had interviews to be screened to make sure that you're appropriate to be a peer support officer. So there's many, many steps to get in, which is great. And then you will get contacted by a peer support officer, usually 48 hours after an incident, and then also contacted again 7 to 14 days post that conversation as well. Sometimes that's face to face, sometimes that's over the phone, depending, because we've got regional and rural co communities of clubs versus our metropolitan. So it looks different for every avenue in that essence. And then essentially, if the peer support officer and the personnel that's involved deemed, I want to keep going and I want to still have more conversations, but I would like to go to the allied health professional that may provide even more additional, but now to the next level of an understanding and awareness and training involved. Then there's a process that goes through. It's all confidential. And when it gets to our EAP member personnel, we have no contact of knowing how, why, when any of that occurs. But that's offered to them, and it's usually anywhere from 5 to 10 conversations with that allied appropriate personnel as well. So there's been a lot of, I guess, work that's come into play to that level, and we've had some workshops. We have our National Mental Health Working Group that has every state, territory, and New Zealand involved in it, as well as Tyler's involved and sits on there as well to give those different perspectives from a volunteer and a staff level. So we're workshopping more around how do we embed more of an evidence-based community practice to come aboard. There's probably some things that we're never going to get from the national level across as a standardized approach, just because there are very many complexities that come into play from different clubs in different states and territories, but finding a common ground to say, here's like best practice, here's our key recommendations that come forward. And regardless of what club you're in, if you're wearing the red and yellow, here's what you can get from resources, training, and the appropriate help that may be involved as well. So there's a lot of good work that's there and a lot more to come in that way as well.
And
That's
one of
pretty
the
impressive.
things, yeah, and one of the things as well, so Sam's just given a great overview of like what happens in Clubland or like for our members. But what's also come out of this research that we've done is that, obviously we are dealing with a highly trained, population cohort of people who are motivated to save people's lives. So often incidents also occur outside of their actual role, and that yet they are trained to respond regardless. And they do. So, whether it be CPR in a shopping center or, an injury somewhere else, like it's something as well that we are trying to capture in our wellbeing framework and trying to understand the best way to manage that as well. At the moment, I think our members have access through their EAPs to some services, and they can actually still, because it's their skills that they've learned through the role that they are using out in the broader community as bystanders, they can still access services through Surf Life Saving. But that's one of the things that really came out and was sort of, highlighted for us about all, the impact and the burden of actually being a trained professional, a trained lifesaver or a lifeguard in the community means that they're actually more likely to respond and assist when needed, which is great because it also means we've got a greater proportion of the community who are actually trained to respond and be there. And that needs to be acknowledged and supported, alongside having those support networks in place so that if they do support and respond to someone, they've got the support that they need and they've got the care that the carers need in the background. So that's something as well that's really important to consider from that community perspective.
Well, that
Yeah.
comes out in our discussions here in Hawaii about
No
responding
doubt.
to something more than just that. They respond to a car incident or somebody having a
Yep,
heart
shark
attack.
attack,
Yeah.
heart attack, motor vehicle accidents. Yeah, it's that first responder mentality, and it's ingrained regardless. And because they're not technically a paramedic or technically they're a professional lifesaver, professional lifeguard who are skilled and have the capacity to respond. And if they're the first person there, then they absolutely should have the right and the legislation, and the support networks to support them to do that.
Yeah, like this week, or actually this past month, we've supported an organization that had a suicide that one of their lifeguard instructors responded to a suicide, and unfortunately, it was not a successful resuscitation. And so, you just never know what you might We never
Great.
disclose specifics about any sort of case, but just to give you an idea of, you just never know when you need these types of services to have in your back pocket. And so it's just so helpful to have trained peer supporters that are trained to both deal with the day-to-day and with the critical incident stress. And if you don't have the capacity and folks trained to deal with the post-incident process, the critical incident stress management, or whatever program you use, then to have some sort of a service on call that can provide that support for you. And so larger organizations that see critical incidents on a regular basis, I would be a proponent of training people to have their own team members trained in that post-incident response process. Whereas some people that are at, they'll say a neighborhood pool that may not see a critical incident once every 5 or 10 years, it doesn't make sense to train somebody there because they're not gonna really, ever get good at it because they don't do it with enough frequency. So it's really kind of a balancing act on our end of determining, let's thoughtfully think and design your program based upon what the needs are of the population.
Well, it's been said here in Hawaii that we're the epicenter of water safety. We're stuck in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and we're a small state. And what I'd like to hear from Jazz and Sam is it clear to me that Australia sees lifeguards or as first responders? Or is that just an issue we're facing here in the United States?
I would say we're definitely seen as first responders, but not necessarily as emergency services.
Okay, can you explain that?
So I think the police and the ambulance and fire organizations are, the classic emergency service organizations, particularly within Australia, but I'm pretty sure that's global. However, I think the role of lifeguards and lifesavers on the beach is, highly acknowledged in Australia and highly, sort of revered, and people love that we have lifeguards and lifesavers. But and I think, they're, because they're known by beachgoers, go and have, go and get a Band-Aid, go and, you've been stung by a bee, go and see the lifeguards, get some support. They're known as a support network, and they're also known as a first responder. But I don't think it's been acknowledged. In some states it has, but in other states it has not been acknowledged that that service is actually an emergency service. Sam, do you want to elaborate on how some of that stuff works from a club level?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's the essence of the complexities that come with our federated model. Some are definitely seen higher in that order. And the examples might be, say, for our like disasters that occur when we have our wet season and we've got cyclones impending. Certain states will be sitting at the table with our emergency responders of our fire, police, and SES. And then other states and territories may be sitting over here on this table, ready to come and assist when they're tapped on the shoulder. So it's kind of depending what state and territory you're in, is where you may be positioned at the table. Some are very much there and sitting side by side with the other frontline emergency responders, and others are over on the side waiting to be like tapped in. And sometimes that's like the communication side as well of going, right, so where and how and what do we need to activate and respond and how does that look like? And sometimes there's like that expectation of like, well, you should be ready because we're always seen near water and in the water. So if there's anything like a cyclone or a flash flooding that's occurring, there's always bound to be a lot of water. So the expectations are there as well. And it's, yeah, trying to meet those expectations, but also ensure from our government and funding bodies as well that we're in scope and staying with where we're currently situated in a state by state territory situation as well.
Well, I think
And
that's probably true in the United States, state by state type of situation. But what you and Jazz have done is really remarkable to me that you've done some great research and then you're tracking what's going on. And so that gives you some kind of longitudinal information to see the trend and how well all these programs that you have established or working. And that goes to this study that you're doing. And so you say you have about 1,000 respondents. This is worldwide, but probably not in Egypt, even though that conference was in Egypt. Did it go to Egypt, the survey?
Tyler, we can't hear.
It was translated, so we do have a number of
Oh,
responses
good.
that are in local languages. I would say probably 85%, last time I checked, and this has been a little bit of time ago, were from Canada and the United States. But also, I don't believe Australia and New Zealand have pushed this out because their swim seasons have, kicked off, and they're waiting for kind of their peak season, I believe, to send it out to their organizations. So, we'll see more submissions internationally. And then we've got a couple of our volunteers that are working on kind of reaching out, which is a slow process, getting people, some of these life-saving organizations in other countries to respond to you, and then coordinating how do we translate, social media posts and things into whatever their native language is, so that it's kind of a slow process. But we do have two volunteers right now that are working on kind of engagement in countries that we're not seeing a lot of responses in.
So I guess what I'd say is that Sam and Jazz, as you said, Tyler, is who you went to because you see Australia as a model for doing this kind of work. And their research and what they described is very impressive. What do all three of you think is going to happen with this research? You've put a lot of time and effort into it. We haven't talked about all the different questions I asked here, but I want to know, you're giving it to next July, is that correct? 2026?
My hope is that at first we were looking at doing this just in the United States, and then we said, hey, you know what? This is a problem elsewhere. I had been speaking to Life Saving Society of Canada's chief operating officer, and it was like, this is not just a United States issue. If you're going to do this, go ahead and do this, and allow countries that want to participate to participate. And then what it does is it allows those countries to say, hey, these lifeguards are experiencing some of the same critical incidents that other first responders have access to. They have access to, grant funding and things to help support mental wellness programs and peer support programs. And it might help them position their organizations to better support their lifeguards. And so that's one hope that I have internationally. In the US, there's not a lot of grant funding that right now that we would qualify for. But that's something that it has not been documented in the academic literature here in the US that lifeguards even experience critical incidents. We as aquatics professionals knew they were, but you've got to start from this foundational level, and build that research to prove this so that we can then look at, hey, what are some funding opportunities that might be able to help equalize the support services that we can offer lifeguards, to things that other first responder groups and support services have kind of had access to. So that's my hope. And I think long term, I'd like to, as Australia does more research with their lifeguards and their research furthers, we're going to be closely watching what's happening with them as well as other countries. And then my goal would eventually to be to like put together a best practice document that life-saving organizations can use around the world to help guide them when they're starting, from scratch and trying to kind of navigate these waters. I think that would be something that would be very helpful to, organizations around the world that are trying to do the same thing as we are here in the United States and as Australia has done.
So getting the lifeguards to fill this survey out is very important.
Very important. And one of the things I do not, we have a, I, the area that I need really help with is getting this out to surf lifesavers. We have had really good engagement from Ellison Associates, Stargard Elite, the Red Cross, has American Red Cross has sent this out to their distribution groups. But we have not had as much engagement with the surf life-saving agencies. And so with your exposure, Margaret, with the Hawaiian Lifeguards Association, that's
Right.
something absolutely I would hope that we can get that distributed. And that we can get adult lifesavers and lifeguards in Hawaii to fill this out so we can capture their unique experiences. Because there are very unique experiences depending on what geographic areas you're working in. You can't, the lifeguards that are working in, Florida on the coast are not experiencing the same things as the lifeguards out in California. We had, the New Hampshire State Beach Patrol had a plane go down, right off the beach, and their lifeguards were, going out and, plucking people out of, the sinking wreckage. And, there's scuba rescues and cliff rescues
Right.
that are being needed by lifeguards in California along the coastline. The exposure to marine wildlife like sharks and in Hawaii and in Australia are they're such a unique experiences that we want to make sure we capture in that survey data. And so the more people that we have take this, the better. It's not we want to hear from everybody. We're not saying, have you experienced a critical incident? We want you to fill this out. No, we want to hear from
Okay.
everybody doing a prevalence and then as well as an impact study to see how did this impact that particular individual.
So you didn't hear back from Kalani. He's very busy, and I will remind him again about the survey because I think it's very
I just
important.
within the last week or so he's but yes, I would love to have any support you can provide in that area to get this out within the islands.
So Sam and Jazz are going to take care of Australia for you. Is that correct?
They're working with us very closely on that, which is great.
Okay.
And then
I've interviewed some people from Brighton and Exeter in the UK with the Surf Life Saving Association. So I could give you their contacts and you could send them the information and I will pass that on to them.
be happy to.
Okay.
One of the
So,
things I might add about benefits, like you asked the question about where do we see this, the benefit of this
yeah.
survey. More broadly, I mean, I would like to think that potentially this survey that Tyler's leading is not just a one-off, and maybe we can do it in a couple of years' time or when it, at whatever the cadence is most suited. However, I think one of the benefits is it's really highlighting the issue of mental health around the world and promoting that it also impacts lifeguards and also that lifeguards and lifesavers are first responders. So it's that awareness building. And that's what we found with our surveys. But it's also like it was very evident at the World Conference of Drowning Prevention that Tyler mentioned in Egypt, it was noted several times of the increase and the basically increased awareness that mental health and well-being is something that needs to be considered when you work with aquatic professionals. So that's one of the things I think that's going to be so amazing about this survey is just getting the word out there and increasing that awareness. So I also suspect that the next time we run it, we'll probably have a greater response because more people will be aware of it and more people will jump on. I suspect some of the countries that maybe have been less responsive may be a little warier about it. Having experienced what we experienced through Surf Life Saving Australia is like that sort of stigma and those conversations. But as it happens more commonly and it's integrated, within practice and people are just talking about it, then, the participation should increase or at least, the acceptance of the materials or the training will be just much more welcomed.
And I think for some, it may be, they're fearful of we're, if we're basically proving there's a problem, once this study and the research is released, we've shined a spotlight on the issue. We're going to have to find a way to deal with this and to mitigate that that risk of psychological injury in the workplace. And so it's something that we can't just sweep under the rug anymore. We have to really take a concerted effort and look at what systems do we have in place and support mechanisms that are necessary. And that's a cost of doing business. If you are going to employ lifeguards that respond to these types of events, especially ones that are, minors or young adults, in my mind, you have a responsibility to ensure they're taken care of when they're exposed to the, events that we train them to respond to. So it's just something that it's kind of a cultural shift for our industry. And it's not because anybody wanted to do something, incorrectly. I think it's new for our industry. And it's something that we're all learning. How do we best handle this? Nobody's at fault. It's just we're all working to figure out how do we do this better and better align with what other first responder groups have, had access to. And it's not about, saying somebody's done something incorrectly, or it really is just an effort of how can we best support? We're here as an industry resource, not to try to strong arm people, but to encourage people to, hey guys, let's do the right thing here.
Well, I think we've.
To add, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think to add to it as well, the surveys provide that opportunity for a lot of our members to advocate and have a voice. And because it's online, because it's anonymous, but you're still representing your country or your area of expertise of your workplace in an aquatic area, you have that opportunity as a member, as a paid staff, wherever your opportunity is that you align with the survey itself, and then using that as an evidence-based practice to then help guide organizations. It's not coming from, an emotional point of view. It's not coming from a conflict of interest or a risk of bias. It's coming from the members from organizations that live and breathe it day in, day out, and they're not then dealing with it from the top high end that they need to either. A lot of members sign up and volunteer or paid because they love what they do and they love being, with the toe, with sand between their toes, being in the water. They love what they want to do. They don't want to be involved in paperwork and regulations and policies and all the other things that come in between it. And I believe that a survey really allows them the opportunity to raise what they want to know and provide their opportunity to really have that understanding and go, here's what I deal with, here's what happens with me, and here's how I feel about it, and here's what I understand, really helps to drive it forward for us within Australia, but also for the platform of an international level as well, as Tyler said, to really be able to provide back and go, here's the key recommendations that come from the voices of the people within the organizations that really know and live and breathe it day in, day out. And I think that's the most exciting thing about these surveys when it comes down to it as well.
That's a great message because if the guards feel they're part of the solution and
Yeah.
they have ownership in this survey, and
Absolutely.
I think that would make a totally different way of looking at it. I don't know what kind of message you send out for that, but what you just said really makes a lot of sense.
Thanks.
That's
I am
why she's
sorry.
our hero.
Gotta jump off now. She's
I know you
I'm gonna
have to
have to
leave, but
I
I
have
just
to
want to
leave,
ask,
otherwise I get push-ups for the bus if I'm
you're in
late.
Thailand. Why don't you tell all our listeners what you're doing in Thailand, Jess?
I'm supervising students for their placement in exercise, sports science, and physiotherapy. They're going to a heap of different centers to help continue a continuity of practice. And sustainability of evidence for exercise in their areas. So it's a beautiful, wonderful experience. But if I'm late for the bus, my students will have to watch me do 20 push-ups. So
Okay.
we won't have that today.
Well, I don't want you to do that. So, if there is any kind of resource you want me to put on after this show that you've done any work, and that would be great for people to read,
Absolutely,
that would
hit me
be
with that. That'd be
fantastic. And we
amazing.
should stay in touch and hear what happens with this study.
Well,
Absolutely. Thank you so
So, we'll
much. And
let I
you
just wanted
go.
to, no, thank you. I just wanted to also sideline for the start of the recording. I don't know how to scrap it in here, but Do you want me to send it in an email just to like flag the bio?
Oh, I'm recording it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just need to make some changes to the recording because I'm not a clinical psychologist, so I just
Oh,
need to get that
okay.
on
Well,
the
then
desk.
I will take that out.
Okay, thank you. I was like, oh, someone will come for me.
And he has her doctorate. I think it's what is it exercise or
Yeah, yeah.
well,
Yeah.
okay. Well, we'll make sure we edit that out. I'll do
Thank you
that.
so
That's all
much.
right.
I
Oh,
appreciate
yes.
it.
My doctorate's in marine science. Bye, Sam. Great to see your face.
Bye. Thank you so much, everyone.
Okay, so we'll do that too. Okay, I'll make sure we change that out.
It's all good.
Really nice to have the international perspective here with the research. Not all countries, and I think this was very apparent, both here in the US, not all countries have the resources to be able to have research managers and doctoral level researchers that are embedded within their life-saving organizations, and especially around the world, other people are looking to countries like Australia and the research that they're doing that is going to help folks around the world figure out how do we do this better. So it's really just such a great collaboration that we have with the International Lifeguard Critical Incident Response Alliance, where we have researchers like Jazz, Sam, Dr. Justin Simstrut, Kristen Horan at Kennesaw State University. So it is really kind of a global team that's helping us with this, and so that's we'll gain some of that perspective from countries around the world of how do we do this in the best way.
Well, I think collaboration is the key, and you said it very well, Tyler. I want to kind of repeat what you said at info@ilcra.org. You can get information about an online course. Is that correct? Can you repeat that again?
So you can go to ilcira.org and go to our training section. You'll see the Resilience First Aid course that's listed there. That's that proactive training. It's open to anyone around the world. There are other courses listed there. The CISM, Critical Incident Stress Management for the Aquatic First Responder, is only being offered to people that are participating in our pilot research study right now. So we are not opening that up yet. So it's only open to Ellison Associates and Stargard Elite clients right now. But in the future, that will open up for registrations as well. But yeah, so you can get more information there. To take the survey, if you go to our website, if you're going to have a pop-up screen that's going to have you sign up for our newsletter, so we can keep you up to date on the research and any publications. And once you sign up for that, it sends you a link to your email to take the survey. So that's how you can access that aquatic personnel prevalence and critical incident impact survey that is running through July of this year.
I appreciate Sam. What would you like to add to this? You're doing some great research over there in Australia. I just want to know if there's anything you want to add to our listeners about what you're doing.
Look, I think at SLSA and obviously the fearless leadership from Sam has really driven what we have achieved over the last 5 years. But I think really making sure that we keep moving together. And I think one of the key things that came out, I think Sam mentioned the mental health working group that we pulled together, which was a collection of members, paid staff. It had representatives from the states, all the different states and territories. It had representatives from lots of different areas, and they all had different expertise. And many of them actually had psychology background as well. So that really helped shape the framework, which is available, which we launched last year at the end of last year. And so it means that the program and the framework itself is member-led, community-led, so it's built by the members for the members. So it's got all of their voices in there, and I think that's really central for anybody wanting to go and look at how do we implement this. Given that our communities are so very passionate and considerate, and they love what they do. I think it's very important to ensure that we have that community voice in there, because then there's that level of ownership, and people can take, like, I helped build this and I helped do this. And then it means that ownership means that the program has longevity, and it just keeps to grow. So I'm really hoping that we see, in Australia, we see what we do grow, but I also am really excited to see how we can help support and promote and collectively, internationally do the same.
I think that's right, Jazz. I'm sorry I called you Sam.
It doesn't matter. I don't mind. I'll be Sam any day.
To me, the word that keeps coming across in interviews I do is collaboration, and that's what you are all doing on a great international level about an issue that nobody talks about for our guards, their mental health. And I hope that we can continue this conversation. This is just one place that it's being talked about. But this conversation reminds us that drowning prevention is not just about the moment of a rescue, it's about everything that comes after. And as we've heard from you, Tyler, Jazz, and Sam, lifeguards and first responders are repeatedly exposed to traumatic events, often without the structured mental health support that matches the seriousness of the job. And you've said that over and over again. And Australia appears to be a gold standard in terms of what they're doing to work with their volunteer groups to understand the pressures they're under and to get people talking about mental health, which in itself is so healthy. Supporting responder mental health through peer support, debriefing, and organizational responsibility isn't an extra. It's a core element of public safety. Healthier guards mean better decisions, stronger teams, and ultimately safer communities, which we've talked about. I'm really grateful to you, Tyler and Jazz and Sam, who came from Thailand, and you in Australia, for advancing this work and for helping shift the conversation towards a more complete evidence-based approach to water safety that includes mental health, a very important issue. So I hope you'll come back and talk about how the survey went and then whatever else you're doing, because I know Kalani Vieira will be very interested in knowing about your work and about Tyler's work in the United States in getting a better conversation going and making everything more resilient, having ownership of the guards to know that they're being listened to and understood, and creating a plan and a structure for resources that makes everyone safer in the community.
Look forward to working with any of the organizations that want to reach out. We're happy to set up a consultation with how we can best support. Margaret, thank you for
That was great. Thank you for the time. I know you're all very busy.
Thanks so much for having us, and thanks for
Yeah.
helping us promote
Well, go over and
our
say
work.
hello to Hoppo.
I will. I think you'll see him before I will. But
Oh, come
yeah,
on.
so
He's right next door, right?
I know he's on the beach. I've got too
Oh,
many
that's
meetings.
right.
I'm
He's on the beach.
yeah. But say hello from me.
Okay. All right, we will
Yeah.
talk soon.
All right. Bye, guys.
Sounds like a plan. Thanks, Margaret. Thanks, Tyler.
Bye.
Yeah.
Bye.